if the whole group could just stick together, that would be great. There is a lot to see in this exhibit, so please don't wander off. Welcome, everybody, to Who Were the White People? The first comprehensive effort by the Field Museum to look at this lost culture, although I should say there are still small colonies of white people in Sweden and in Canada.
Who's that?
That's Clint Eastwood. Please don't put your hands on the glass. He was a famous white person, and white people believed he could talk to chairs.
What's that thing?
That's a snowmobile. Snow was much more common during the era when white people roamed the earth, and they really liked to ride on these.
You mean like for transportation?
No, they would go out on one and ride around in the cold and then come back to where they started.
Why?
I don't know. But we're getting ahead of the story. One thing that we've learned through archaeological studies is that white people were not merely the plunderers, raiders, and exploiters of resources that our tradition tells us about. Their culture was more complex than we'd previously supposed. One of you, please push that green button over there.
Out in the sticks with the squirrels and the ticks and my 30-06. I'm running out of Miller Lite trucks and park. The dog won't bark, couple hours till dark, wishing one would walk by. Might as well left my gun in the gun rack, been here all day. All I kill's a 12-pack, sitting here waiting on a deer.
That was actual music that they made. We think it may have been incorporated into their religion somehow, but, you know, we're really not sure.
Who's that?
Her name was Ann Coulter. Anthropologists are still sorting out some of the nuances, but it does seem as though some people were whiter than others, and that there were some who believed that white people were better than the other races living nearby, and these people called themselves white supremacists. I know, it's funny, right? But they really did believe it. Now you're going to listen to something called Public Radio, and this is a show they did back in those days about white people. And this is a man we believe was some kind of tribal jester or a fool of some sort. Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, so welcome to this show about, it's not really anthropologically about white people. It's about, in fact, how white people perceive their economic and social statuses right now, what that contributed to the outcome of the 2016 election, and a bunch of other related issues. And we know that it did contribute to the 2016 election. We know it not only rhetorically, but we know it numerically, supporting Donald Trump by a massive 39-point margin. 39-point margin nationally, were working-class white voters. And obviously, in the rhetoric of this election, there was a lot of talk going back and forth about the notion that white America had lost ground, that white people felt disenfranchised, placed at some kind of disadvantage. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about how it's a little bit of a pattern repeating itself, or maybe a lot of a pattern repeating itself. Near the end of the show, we're also going to talk about the rise of white studies programs at universities. But first, let me tell you who's with us right now. Charles Gallagher, department chair and professor of sociology at LaSalle University, author of Rethinking the Color Line, Readings in Race and Ethnicity. Daniel Kubias, writer for the Huffington Post, specializing in Latino culture, and the creator of the website The Hispanic Fanatic. He's the author of the novel Barrio Imbroglio. And Carol Anderson, Charles Howard Candler Professor of African American Studies at Emory University. She's the author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. So, Charles Gallagher, I'm going to kind of ask you to maybe at least set up this narrative that we've heard in this last electoral cycle. It's not entirely a new narrative, depending on how much attention you're paying to what people are saying on comment threads, on conservative websites. But what's the argument being made about white losses that needed to be made up for?
Well, I think that whites have come to believe and see themselves as victims. And I think that you said the word, and I think the word is correct. It's perceptions. Perceptions are reality. Whites believe now that they have been taken over, that if you're a white male, you feel that everyone is basically getting ahead at your expense. It's a zero-sum game. And, you know, I mean, if you look at very good polling data, and I'd like to go through one or two points of it, is that if you look at white evangelicals, if you ask them, they believe they're more discriminated against than blacks in the United States. 60% of white working class folks think that discrimination against whites is as big a problem as discrimination against blacks. What they believe is that there's equal discrimination against all groups. And in the net, that whites have basically been thrown to the winds because of political correctness. And there's a whole litany. I think there's a whole group of constituents that have been cobbled together. It could be about gay rights. It could be prayer in school. It could be DC elites. It could be Hollywood elites. It could be many people that feel traditional values have been eroded. And this is an affront. It's really in a list of affronts to white folks. And I think also, Colin, the one thing that is important, and I've been studying whites for the last 20 years here in Pennsylvania, in Colorado, in Georgia. I just got back from a Fulbright in the UK for 6 months interviewing white people. And there is a perception, and I think the perception really drives how people vote and how they think, that whites believe they're a minority. And so if you look at very good polling data, Pew, Gallup, the average American in the United States here, they think that blacks represent 39% of the population. They think that Latinos are 33% of the population. If you ask the average American, they believe that foreigners constitute 38% of the population, when in fact blacks are 12%, Latinos are 16%, and the foreign-born population in the United States of America is 13%. And we know from the literature that if you perceive group sizes being bigger than they are, then it is a threat to you and you vote accordingly. So there is a lot of delusion going along just in how you perceive the country. You think you're a minority in a country where you're still very much the majority. And then also, quite honestly, a lot of the things that Trump said, I mean, this is call it what it is, they're lies. The fact is that the best economic data is out there is that immigrants are not taking jobs away from white folks. And if you look at crime, the whole idea of the Mexican rapist, the fact is the safest neighborhoods to live in, bar none, in the United States of America are neighborhoods with large foreign-born population. And the idea that they overuse social services, again, these are not truths. The fact is that Donald Trump repeated these over and over again, and there's a ton of excellent social science data that says that what he said, I don't want to say falses, they're lies, but he repeated them over and over again. It tapped these insecurities about white privilege being attacked, about basically, as Mo Brooks said, right, the war on whites. I mean, so this is a general framework of a really delusional picture of America and the threat that basically people are making gains at their own expenses.
Now, one thing that's not delusional, at least I think you're going to agree with me about this, is that the trend lines ultimately do point in that direction. I think in 2015, there was one study indicating that among Americans 5 years old or less, whites were a minority. And we know that, what, by 2050 anyway, they will be a minority. I mean, this is an irreversible trend that it hasn't come now. They have very distorted and inflated understandings of the way the picture is now. But they're not wrong, I assume, Charles, about where all this is heading.
Well, they are wrong. I'll tell you why that's wrong. So if you want to look at non-Hispanic whites in the United States of America, it's about 64%. If you include Latinos that, again, this is self-definition. People can define however they want. Half of the almost 60 million Latino Americans, they define themselves as white. They're allowed to put whatever they want, and they put down white. Now, there's some different polls that have come out, but the fact is, if you include Latinos in the United States of America that are increasingly defining themselves as white, or mixed race families where they define a child as white, you could argue that the fact is that we are pretty much holding our own. So if you include all those groups, it's 72% of the population is white. We are still a white country run by white people. And all you have to do is look at the halls of power, Congress, Senate, you know, CEOs of Fortune 100 companies, right? Who's elected judges? You know, it's white men are 35% of the population. They still control everything. So I would say even that number is basically used basically as a fear factor. They're taking over. And demographers will tell you that it's very hard to predict 50 years out because you don't know what's going to happen. So even that, I think, is a contentious assertion that does nothing but say to people, oh, my God, they're taking over.
Right.
And they is the other.
And I mean, the other thing we have to point out is that obviously one of the big demographic trends is mixed race, you know, and probably some of our ideas about race are going to change as there are more and more mixed race families of all different, all kinds, all possible kinds of mixed race families.
Absolutely.
So we have to sort of maybe tease out a little bit more where some of this anxiety is coming from. Daniel Kubiyas, I assume one of the places that this came from most recently is the 2007-2008 recession, and a sense once again, I'm sure economic data doesn't bear it out very well, but probably a sense among a certain segment of white America. I mean, all whites are not the same. White people do not speak as one, to say the obvious. But a certain segment of white America was probably thinking, wow, this hit us especially hard. Do you think that has been a part of what we saw over the last 8 years?
Oh, it definitely has been. Yes, the recession actually hit Latinos hard, much harder than it hit white people. But I think the perception among white people was that they got nailed harder. And it's part of gets back to white privilege. I think if my family is are immigrants, and when you're immigrants, I think you're starting your life over. You're willing to do whatever it takes to get ahead. You're really working hard, striving ahead, and you don't really have this big sense of entitlement. I think there is a sense of entitlement for people who are fifth, sixth generations white Americans who might say, well, everything's been going pretty well if I just played by the rules and I got my house, I got my family, and everything's going well. And then when things get pulled out from underneath you, it's hard to say, well, there must be some sort of problem with the system here. It's easier to say, well, it's immigrants, or so they're the ones who are taking the jobs away. And of course, the data doesn't show that at all. So I think when the recession happened, it was very hard for and the recession hit men harder of all races, but especially white men who were losing out. It was very hard to say, hey, I played by the rules, I haven't done anything wrong, and I'm used to being in charge. So what's going on here? Who can I point a finger at? Who can I blame? And the answer throughout American history has been the immigrants.
Carol Anderson, I mean, one of the other obvious factors here was the election of President Obama in 2008, a mixed race president, really, who self-identified as black. What did that do to shape the kinds of feelings that we're talking about right now?
I think it punctuated that sense of fear that even the most sacred space of power in the United States was now not walled off from black people. So when you have an Obama come to power being elected by 15 million new voters, and included in that is 2.2 million new African Americans, 2 million new voters who are Hispanic, 600,000 new Asian American voters who are at the polls in 2008 when they hadn't been there before. That created such a shockwave, such a tremor, that this is one of the reasons why we saw this wave of massive voter suppression laws coming through, because it was this fear of the only way that we can maintain power is to see to it that those groups do not vote, that we create an obstacle and then we create an obstacle to the obstacle, such as photo ID, but then we shut down the departments of motor vehicles in areas where blacks and Latinos live. That was the response, the vitriolic, and I would have to say as well, nonsensical. It not based in reality. A part of that was, you know, we talked about the recession.
Mm-hmm.
African Americans got hit so hard in that recession. They lost 31% of their wealth, whereas whites lost about 11%. That disparity in wealth loss was already based on massive disparities, where a recent study showed that it was going to take African Americans 228 years to equal the wealth of whites in the United States. And so the kind of economic anxiety that we heard repeated over and over again during the 2016 election is not based on reality.
So, Charles, you said before perception is reality for a lot of people. And I think about that moment, that night in 2008, how excited I was, how excited many Americans were to see something happen that many of us weren't sure that we would live to see. But, I mean, there was a segment of white America looking at this through a different set of goggles and looking at not just Barack but Michelle Obama, too, and seeing essentially two people who had risen to where they were as a result of a set of on-ramps that existed for them and maybe not for white people, that these were probably, I mean, once again, for people looking through these particular goggles, these were two people who were products and beneficiaries of the affirmative action system that it existed really to produce results like this one. You say you've been studying whites for several decades now in Pennsylvania. I assume that's something that you hear a lot in your studies.
I have. I also spent 11 years in Atlanta, and I was interviewing in North Georgia quite a bit. And it's a very common narrative about, you know, that this is unfair. And, you know, of course, this is, again, very selective attention to history. I mean, I'm a white guy, and I am the largest beneficiary of affirmative action imaginable. It's called my father in the GI Bill. It's called, you know, I grew up in Philadelphia in a row house, but I had decent public schools. My father got his house for a song for basically it was almost free through the GI Bill. And he went to a teacher's college, and then he got his master's in history all through the GI Bill. The fact is that there has always been affirmative action, and the affirmative action has been for white people because racial minorities have been excluded from, you know, if you were black and you were in the service, if you could even get to a college, it had to be a historically black college. And then if you got a degree, you couldn't get a job. So, I mean, again, this is very, very selective attention that, you know, and I think that Daniel and Carol are spot on. The fact is that the wealth disparities and really that loss was really in basically the depletion of wealth investments in the house. The fact is that it's a dime on the dollar for every 10 cents of wealth that racial minorities have. Whites have a dollar. And when you basically clip that, if you're middle class and educated, the numbers skyrocket. So, I mean, the thing is, I don't want to use the word delusional, but it's fanciful. I mean, I think Carol's point is very important, that the only way that whites are going to maintain, you know, the ballot is through things like suppression law. And I think that, I mean, Carol said it's nonsensical. I think it's completely sensical if you want to maintain white privilege. And I think the real narrative now, which really scares me, is suppression law wasn't about suppression at all. It was about voter fraud. And I thought it was going to vomit. I mean, there's no studies at all that demonstrate there's any substantial voter fraud. And this is, of course, beyond yesterday, what Trump said. This is years ago. Yet this is exactly how we talk about voting or affirmative action, right? Colorblindness in the Roberts Court. Chief Justice will not talk about the word race. So colorblindness is the new narrative. And this is a way that whites are going to basically say, hey, the playing field is level. We got a Barack Obama. Let's get rid of race. When in fact, every single quality of life indicator says that race matters enormously in the United States. I mean, this is about ideological politics. And it's about rhetoric. And if you say it enough times, the folks that voted for Donald Trump, you know, and I guess we really should say, if you look at it, and Daniel said it quite well, the fact is that white men in certain regions have been creamed. And we see it through opiate use and heroin use. And these are rural communities where they've seen the mills and the manufacturing go away. And you know what? Daniel's exactly right. They said, you know what? I assumed I wouldn't be working at Walmart at 30 and living in my mother's basement. And I really think that the people that really brought Trump to power, you know, we can have this stereotype of the 55-year-old white man that's a, you know, a moonshine drinking hillbilly, but that isn't true at all. The fact is that population is, in fact, makes a little more money than the national average. They typically own their home. They have a small retirement. But when they look at their children and their grandchildren, their nieces and nephews, the American dream is gone for them. And they want to blame someone. And they found it.
All right, let's hear what that sounds like when it's done on the radio. Here's a clip of course, Rush Limbaugh.
The idea here that there's still some effort out there to deny minorities the right to vote. If anything, there is an effort to count their votes more than once. If anything, there is an effort to get people not even qualified to vote. The idea that there's an effort to squash minority voting is absurd. It's just the exact opposite. Everybody's pandering to them. And the way the Democrats operate, they're trying to see to it that minorities can vote multiple times. Early voting, absentee voting, same-day voter registration as voting. All of this is aimed at overwhelming an electoral system that can't keep up with the fraud. As though there's still this effort from the 1800s to deny the right to vote. As I said, the effort is to get those people voting multiple times.
Got a call or a question here from Steve in Franklin. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Colin. How are you?
Fine.
I like the shows you do. They're very provocative and informative. But one question I have, and I'll take the answer off the air, is I've heard for months and perhaps years the idea of why it's not correct to have photo IDs for people to vote. I mean, we have photo IDs for so many other things, driver's licenses, etc. We have to show it when we're going to banks. Mm-hmm. To me, it It is not a difficulty. It's a very, you go to a voting booth and someone says, can I see your ID? And fine, and you show it. Everyone should have that when they show. And I, for the life of me, do not know why, and I have not heard a good explanation.
All right, I think you're about to hear a good explanation. I'm going to start with Carol. Hi, Carol.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah.
And so it sounds innocuous, but let's take Alabama, for instance. Alabama said you have to have a government-issued photo ID. And then it took off things like your public housing ID that is issued by the government does not count. Instead, it really has to be basically a driver's license. Then the governor of Alabama shut down the Department of Motor Vehicles in the Black Belt counties, which are the counties where you had a predominantly black population, and shut down the Department of Motor Vehicles in those areas. So then access to the photo ID then was basically denied by the state because white areas had the Department of Motor Vehicles there. Or we take Texas. What Texas did was Texas, when it passed its photo ID law, said certain IDs are not eligible, like a student ID even from the University of Texas, which is a state university. But what you do need, for instance, is a photo ID, a government-issued photo ID, like a driver's license. Texas has over 200 counties, but only 80-some of those counties actually has a Department of Motor Vehicles. When the Texas legislature was writing the law, it recognized that some people were going to have to drive 250 miles to get that government-issued photo ID. Then Texas decided to mark out the line that said, and we will reimburse people for having to drive 250 miles. So you're basically taking what usually is a working class person who's unable to get off work during the work week, but the Department of Motor Vehicles, A, aren't open in your area, and B, they aren't in your area. So what the government has done, so we talked about obstacles, creating an obstacle to the obstacle. So they say you need a certain type of government-issued photo ID, and then we're going to deny access, equal access, for you to be able to get that government-issued photo ID. And if you want it, you're going to have to pay dearly to get it. That's a poll tax.
You know, I would also just kind of layer on top of all that, that voting's a right. I mean, I don't have a right to drive a car. I got to do all kinds of things to, you know, to get to drive a car, and one of those things includes getting a driver's license with a photo ID. Voting and driving don't have the same status, civic status in America. You know, voting ought to be something that they try to make sure you're able to do, as opposed to making it as hard as possible to do. Steve, does this answer your question?
Yes, it does, in a sense. Now, all the things that your guest described are wrong, and they should be corrected so that everyone, first of all, I think everyone should be required to get a photo ID, and secondly, it should be made easy enough so that they can go to AAA, or they can go to Motor Vehicle, or they can go to other government agencies to get it. The idea of a photo ID is not wrong. It's the way it's being handled that's incorrect.
But would you have to also agree that a photo ID ought to have to be free?
Excuse me?
Would you also agree that that photo ID that you're saying that everybody ought to have one and then need to have one in order to vote, should that photo ID be free? Should you be able to get a photo ID for absolutely nothing?
Well,
because if not,
I
you're telling
you feelings on that.
Well,
probably, or maybe a minimal cost.
Yeah, I mean, you shouldn't charge people to vote, right? It shouldn't
exactly cost
any money to vote. So, if
well,
you're going
to,
yeah,
add
go
to
ahead,
him for
go ahead. Sure.
So, I think also that one thing that you know, Carol is, I mean, is a really excellent analysis of what's going on. But you have to ask yourself is that what is the intent of doing this?
Mm-hmm.
And this is where disparate impact comes in.
Yeah.
Look at what groups would be basically differentially impacted by these laws. And it was, we know who is going to basically wind up not voting, groups that historically have voted Democratic. So, I mean, it's cynical to say that this is about voter fraud. This wasn't about voter fraud.
No.
It was about disenfranchising populations that might vote a certain way. And so, I mean, that's really what, I mean, everything, the obstacles is exactly right. But the larger point was, how do we make sure, again, elections are won at the margins. How do you keep these folks out? And so is it surprising that these folks are disproportionately black and or poor and are old? I mean, we're not surprised because that was the intent of these statutes. It was to keep these people out of the poll. You know, it is, as Carol said, it is a poll tax. It's a modern poll tax. And it's disingenuous to say it's anything but that, given that there is no voter fraud.
Daniel Kubiyas, if we could just sort of switch gears here for 1 second before we go to a break here. I think another thing that I've seen rising up, and it's nothing new. It's been around for a while. But, you know, every story, every narrative needs enemies. And in this story of imagined white disenfranchisement or white oppression, you know, some of the enemies are people of color and immigrants. But I think the other enemy, if you look at some of the polling of these people who feel so upset, the other enemy is the government, right? That white people no longer believe that the government's there to help them, and particularly working class white people are inclined to say by overwhelming margins that the government is more likely to interfere with their realization of their life goals than help them to their realization of their life goals. And does this strike you as either interesting or significant?
A little bit of both. But well, first, let me add, until you played that clip on Rush Limbaugh, yeah. I had no idea I was entitled to more than one vote. I would have used 19 of them against Trump.
Help yourself.
But as far as legislation, you know, I think that has always just been a convenient straw man. Affirmative action has been beaten up on for 30, 40 years now. And yet, when you ask someone how many black people at your organization have been hired because they were black or because they were Latino, I find hard to believe they could point to too many people. This has just been a convenient straw man. Without legislation like that, there would still be an incredible amount of animosity toward racial minorities. And the government, I think, has been viewed as – I think the problem that a lot of people have with the government, if they're white males – are sort of exactly what we were saying earlier, which is they run the place. You know, white men are about 30% of the population, and they're about 60% of Congress or three-quarters of Trump's cabinet. And so there is this perception, well, why aren't they doing more for me? The only programs I hear about are programs that are going to help legal immigrants get cell phones and things like that, which, you know, is nonsense, of course. And so the government becomes a punching bag because I think and legislation becomes a punching bag because all they hear about are these things that are supposedly going to keep them oppressed and help other people when they're really not. And they want more for themselves because, like I said, they run the place and they can't figure out that dichotomy, that juxtaposition.
We're going to take a little break here. We want to say that we've been talking also to, you just heard, Daniel Kubiyas, writer for the Huffington Post, specializing in Latino culture, and the creator of the website The Hispanic Fanatic. He's the author of the novel Barrio Imbroglio. We'll be back with our other guests after this.
White people are so scared of black people. They bulldoze out to the country and put up houses on little loop-de-loop streets while America gets its heart cut right out of its chest. The Berlin Wall still runs down Main Street, separating East Side from West.
All right, we're back. We're exploring on this show the notion that rippled through the 2016 election and ripples through many other discourses these days, that white people were responding in this election to a sense that they'd lost ground and that something had happened, that, in fact, they might be disenfranchised or otherwise oppressed. Helping us to do this is Charles, I know, a little crazy, Charles Gallagher, department chair and professor of sociology at LaSalle University, author of Rethinking the Color Line, Readings in Race and Ethnicity, and Carol Anderson, Charles Howard Candler, professor of African American Studies at Emory University. She's the author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We want to go back in history a little bit and talk about the fact that, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. And in some many ways, this conversation that we're having right now could just as easily have taken place, at least in certain ways, during the time of Reconstruction and at other pivotal points in American history. So, Carol Anderson, get us started on this. There is a cyclical nature to this notion that white America has lost ground and needs to do something about it.
Oh, absolutely. One of the key elements that I trace in white rage is that whenever there is some element of black progress, that the response is white rage. And white rage, I don't mean the burning of a cross or anything like that, but through a whole series of public policies and judicial decisions that are designed to undercut that progress. So we see it in Reconstruction, where coming out of slavery, the South passes, southern states pass a series of laws called the Black Codes. And the Black Codes say, hey, you got to sign a labor contract, an annual labor contract. You can't leave your job for a better pay or better work conditions. If you refuse to sign a labor contract, the sheriff will arrest you, and we will auction you off. You can't hunt, you can't fish, and your children get to stay with their old master if you haven't been able to get to them fast enough from when they have been sold in slavery. So it is to reinscribe slavery by another name, to control that labor, because whites felt that blacks moving from property to human being to citizen was just too much. It was, as Andrew Johnson basically said, he saw it as a zero-sum game. If blacks get rights, it can only be at the expense of whites.
Charles Gallagher, probably the, I mean, we're skipping around or skipping ahead and compressing a lot just in the interest of time. We could talk a lot about what happened during Reconstruction, but there certainly was a second backlash. It happens during the era of civil rights, of Brown versus the Board of Education, and the years that spilled out from there. How would you describe the way that that particular cycle resembled or didn't resemble Reconstruction?
Well, I think it reads, I mean, in many ways, this is about resources. And just look at white flight in the United States. I mean, in 1954, of course, Brown happens in 54. It's really not until the 70s that schools are really in any meaningful way integrated. And by that time, at least in Atlanta, they set up Christian schools. That's what set up private schools as a way, because no white family is going to have their kids sitting next to a black kid. So, of course, they privatized. In the North here, I mean, and this is funny about whites losing out of resources. It's like, well, go to a suburb in Philadelphia. My daughters are both in high school. They attend schools that are like colleges. They're unbelievable because it's based on property taxes. Mm-hmm. Cross the line. I'm a quarter mile from Philadelphia, from the city line. When you step over into Philadelphia, these schools have been cut to the bone. They have no resources. They have no sports. They have no theater. They have one nurse for five schools. I mean, so this is just a continuation of basically creating environments that are so onerous for one population to basically move up and out. And so it just, again, it's a repetition, again, in colorblind ways. We can say this is about the tax code. It has nothing to do about race, but of course it does. So, I mean, this is, again, I mean, the new Jim Crow is exactly as Carol said. There were just ways to basically force folks, black folks, into what is basically, imagine a sheriff that basically control the labor population by arresting people, mm-hmm. And then you're arrested and now to work off your time, you have the 2 years in the field. It was slavery. So, I mean, I think it just manifests itself in different ways now, is that it's controlling populations. And, of course, the prison industrial complex is one of the best ways to think about this. Mm-hmm. But, it's, again, every generation has another way, another devious and inventive way. I mean, of course, now we can't say it's about race because that's illegal. So we hide it behind other things. We hide it. And the work I'm doing now is on colorblindness. And colorblindness is increasingly becoming institutionalized. Mm-hmm. So it looks normal, but what it functions to do is to basically say that the playing field is level and maximize white privilege and do it in a non-racist way.
I have a lot of things I'd like to say about that, but I want to just go back to the 1950s for a second, Carol. I mean, as Charles was just saying, there are things that you could say at other times that you can't say now. There's that Lee Atwater quote that has resurfaced recently about what you could say in 1968 and then what she started saying later. But in the 1950s, you didn't really have to disguise it. There was a term of called massive resistance. I mean, to explain massive resistance, it's a pretty open declaration of what was going to be attempted.
Absolutely. So after the Brown decision of 54, you had over 100 senators and congressional representatives basically sign a declaration of war against the Supreme Court decision, saying we will launch massive resistance against the Supreme Court decision. We're not going to have it. And that sent the signal. When you have these august, respectable folks basically saying we are not going to abide by the law, and we're giving sanction to that. And that's what happened. So you had these states create basically to shut down the public school systems, then divert tax dollars into paying tuition for white children to go to all-white private academies, while there was absolutely no education available whatsoever for black children. Now, what the state said was, oh, we have met the standard of Brown. We have equal public education. Nobody gets educated. So, again, it looks colorblind, but the response is absolutely designed to advance whites and to hurt blacks. So in Prince Edward County in Virginia, for instance, you had the public school system shut down for 5 years. And so imagine you're in the fifth grade and your school system doesn't open up until you're in the 10th grade. Imagine all of the education that you have lost out on. Meanwhile, white children were able to just sail through the private academies paid for with public dollars. So that is how, that was a major element of the way that the states were able to get around Brown, was they resisted until the rest of the piece had worked in place, which was the development of the suburbs. So you had whites then moving out to the suburbs, and then you had the cities that were economically devastated and unable, and sanctioned by the Supreme Court in, I believe, the 1973 decision in Rodriguez, that property taxes were absolutely viable and okay, even when they created a disparate funding source. So that in San Antonio, the poor district, taxing itself at the highest level, only generated $21 per student, whereas the very rich, virtually all-white area, Alamo Heights in San Antonio, generated over $300 per student. There is a fundamental difference in what you can do with $21 per student to what you can do with $300 per student.
But Charles,
that's okay.
Charles, this isn't how we tell the story, right? For the most part, I mean, we just celebrated Martin Luther King Day. For the most part, the American narrative is there was a civil rights era that included court decisions and the demonstrations and other activities of Martin Luther King and other leaders of that movement, followed by passage of civil rights laws at the federal level. And there were hard-won gains that were made during that era. And that's not an illusion, but the stories that you and Carol just told are usually not included in that. I mean, in a way, I think we've kind of smoothed out the upward curve and said, you know, there was this incredible period of time of upheaval and change, and important gains were made. We don't really talk about the ways in which those gains were consciously undermined.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that people, it's selective attention, and I think what constantly happens and is that we have amnesia, that we just forget that this is part of our past. I mean, and it's even worse. I mean, Carol is exactly right to say that this stuff wasn't under the table. This was all out. See, now, of course, we don't want to talk about that because that would mean that the system was rigged. And if the system is rigged, it means it's white privilege. I mean, fast forward to 2016 and look at polling data. And if you ask whites around the country a series of questions, and this is everyone, New York Times, Gallup, everyone's done these studies. If you ask white Americans about basically mobility and you ask them about equality, most white Americans now believe that everyone has equal access to the same kind of schooling. White Americans believe that blacks are treated equally by the police. They believe that if folks don't get ahead, it has nothing to do with discrimination, nothing to do with, you know, anything to do with the market. It has to do with basically people being lazy, a list of stereotypes. So when I talk with my undergraduates, who I do quite often, you know, and these are kids that they aren't racist in the sense of like the kind of, you know, biological racism. They certainly have embedded stereotypes. But these are young people today. They very much believe that there is a level playing field. They get some aspects of inequality. But this is, again, getting back, and maybe I'm pushing the colorblind line too much, but how do you talk about racism, racial inequality, institutional racism, if most white Americans believe now that people have equality, that police officers treat blacks the same way or Latinas the same way? If you don't get ahead, you're the architect of your own demise because you have some cultural lacking. See, this is the real problem, is that I think we're at a time now where it's almost impossible to talk about racial inequality and institutional racism, people say, what are you talking about? Look at the president. You know, look at the last attorney general. So this is the dilemma that I find ourselves in. And I think it does enormous ideological work that we can't even be honest about the things Carol told us about that get us to here.
All right, we're going to take a little break here. Thanks so much to Carol Anderson, Charles Howard Candler, professor of African American Studies at Emory University. She's the author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to tell you about the growing field, I think growing field, of whiteness studies.
With his back against the wall, why stop at hating just one of them when you could just hate them all? Another angry white American man with a gun. Another angry white American man.
You can take a lot of things away from us white people, but you can't take away Barry Manilow. Actually, could you take away Barry Manilow? Today's show was produced by Josh Nalea and me, Kyone Wolf. Our intern is Whitey Fisher. The part of Bill Curry was played by Kevin Costner. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and many other platforms. On tomorrow's show, why Ayn Rand speaks to conservatives. Or does she? And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, this has been the weirdest week on this show. But yes, so we're going to go from this topic to tomorrow, Ayn Rand. And I guarantee you, you will find this fascinating. I hope you've found this fascinating, too. I'm sure that you have. I just wanted to sort of follow up with one little personal observation from everything that Charles and Carol were saying in the previous segment. It's something that we've been talking a lot about at the church that I attend. And I was having lunch with one of my friends from the church. And we've been talking a lot about race and sort of how it gets talked about and how it doesn't get talked about. And we were talking about the phrase that's very popular these days. It's, I think Charles's version of it is color blindness, the I don't see color. And it's something that Stephen Colbert's had a lot of fun with in the past. And I was saying to my friend, when people say that to me, I don't see color, I think, well, then you probably missed a lot of really nuanced things that happened. And chances are you also probably offended some people of color over time. I mean, saying that you don't see color, I know it sounds like you mean well, but chances are it's not necessarily a good way to go through life. Maybe someday it will be. But right now, you kind of have to pay attention to some of this stuff and sort of, you know, how it sounds to other people, because it doesn't necessarily sound the way it sounds to you. And that might be a good segue. Charles Gallagher, by the way, still with us, department chair, professor of sociology at LaSalle University, author of Rethinking the Color Line, Readings in Race and Ethnicity. Now joining us, Amy Wilkins, associate professor of sociology at University of Colorado at Boulder, where she teaches a course on whiteness studies. Hi, Amy Wilkins, and maybe begin by telling us what whiteness studies actually is.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
So whiteness studies is a field that really emerged as part of the larger field of sociology of race and ethnicity, and not just sociology, but broader than that. And it's really part of this broader trend where people who study inequality were saying, hey, you know, we've spent all this time looking at subordinated groups, the people at the bottom, and that tells us a lot of stuff, but maybe we need to turn and look at the people in power to understand how power works. And so, you know, people did that with men, and people did that with white people as well. And so that's where whiteness studies comes from, is kind of turning the lens away from looking at people of color and looking at white people and how power works from the top.
So, I mean, what help me understand a little bit more what a typical curriculum would be, or what a syllabus would be in this field.
Okay, so I don't know if my syllabus is typical, but essentially what I do is I ask students to think about where this idea of whiteness came from historically. Like, when did we invent this category of whiteness? Because we haven't always talked about white people as white people. You know, we used to be European or British. So where did this idea come from? And then what does it do? How do we use this idea of whiteness? And then how do white people do different things with this category of whiteness? How do we hoard resources? How do we get power with it? And then how do people understand being white differently in different places? So it's different to be white in the South, for example, than it is to be white in the North. It's different to be white in Appalachia than it is to be white in Detroit. So thinking about white identities in different spaces differently.
So, I want to swing over to Charles for a second. I mean, I think Amy makes a really interesting point, too, which is that a word like whiteness is as much socially constructed as anything else, and it has meant a lot of different things. And probably at the turn of the century, from 19th to 20th, you know, you wouldn't necessarily, some white people, some quote-unquote white people, wouldn't necessarily include recent immigrants who were either Jewish or Irish or Italian in the category of white. This isn't even a term that's had a very consistent meaning.
No, I think that you're exactly right. And Amy, I think, is a very good description of what I've taught a class called Sociology of Whiteness, actually in Colorado some time ago. And, you know, I've kind of moved away from that because it's very loaded. But I routinely, I'm teaching a race class right now, and I talk about the social construction of whiteness, and I use my own identity. You know, I'm Irish on one side, and there's a fabulous literatures that exist about the Irish occupied a kind of liminal space. You know, they weren't black, but they weren't white. They were kind of thought of being the missing link between, England and Africa. And, you know, again, this kind of scientific racism. I'm Sicilian on the other side. So, you know, if you're Southern Italian, you're dark skinned. I also have a sickle cell trait I always bring up in class. What does it mean for the one drop rule? The larger point is that whiteness is a social construction like any other race. And I use the same line that Amy uses, that, you know, it's turning the lens back on the dominant group. I mean, one of the things about being the dominant group, the beauty of it is that you don't have to attend to your own race. You can talk about other races or the pathology of other races, and you don't really have to look at yourself at all. And so what white studies does, is, and it really came out of really, I always think about three waves. The first wave was kind of a critique with black reconstruction, and then it came out of literary studies, and there was a lot of the white studies came out of legal discourse. And I think now we're at a point where people are doing really, really good ethnographic work. They're doing really good qualitative work. And as Amy said, that whiteness plays out. It's a big country. There's 200 million white people, and there are pockets of culture where people in Minnesota are different from Atlanta, different from Philadelphia. So it's looking at, you know, how does whiteness play out? What does it mean? And, you know, I mean, for an example right now, it's like, why is it that mortality rates for whites have basically gotten worse? You know, so, and why is drug addiction right now a problem within white communities? So these are just some of the things that people might, or why is it in law firms or accounting firms, is it the fact that whites tend to find themselves basically running the show? And this, so all this is basically using social science to look at basically whiteness, and it's partly opportunity hoarding, but it's also about culture.
Amy, I apologize real quick because we are running out of time. Is there more interest now in this field, particularly after November of 2016? Does this put a spotlight on what you teach?
I would say that there's definitely more interest, but there was more interest after all of the things started to happen with the police shootings of black youth, or at least all the attention came to that. Mm-hmm. A lot of my students are really interested in thinking about themselves as white people, and I think it's really empowering for them to think about themselves as white people because it gives them tools for thinking about how they can operate in the world differently. So there, I think that there's actually a lot of thirst on the part of a number of white students to really have the tools to think about themselves critically and think about how they can operate in the world differently.
All right. We're going to have to stop there. We've got great guests, and we could talk for another hour or two, but we can't. Amy Wilkins, Associate Professor of Sociology at University of Colorado at Boulder, where she teaches a course on whiteness studies. And Charles Gallagher, Department Chair and Professor of Sociology at LaSalle University, author of Rethinking the Color Line, Readings in Race and Ethnicity. Thanks so much to Josh Nalea. This episode was his idea. Thanks to Wolfie for running the board and picking out the music. And okay, you can start sending emails to me because I know some of you are going to be really upset. So it's Colin, Colin, at WNPR.org. WNPR.org. Just let it fly. Don't hold back.
And here in the early 2000s section of our Who Were the White People exhibit, the 45th president of the United States, Donald Trump.
Wait a minute. He's not white. He's orange.
That's right, he is. But following President Obama, orange was arguably the new black. Now, moving on to Louisiana State Representative David Duke.